Today I will continue the discussion of Dirac fermions on the honeycomb lattice. So I will talk about how this gaplessness of Dirac fermions are protected by symmetries of the system, and then understanding that, you can then figure out how to gap out those Dirac fermions. Namely, that you can put various mass terms to gap out Dirac fermions, and they will correspond to some microscopic terms in your Hamiltonian. And then one special type of perturbations will lead to a very famous phase called chain insulator that is a topological phase which is very important in condensed matter, quantum matter in recent one or two decades. So yeah, that's the plan. And let's continue with the Dirac fermions. Let me first remind you what I have talked about in the last lecture, right? So the Hamiltonian that we consider is really just a tight bonding model on the honeycomb lattice, where I just have nearest neighbor hoppings, whose Hamiltonian schematically are like just hoppings between A and B sublattices. So that's the Hamiltonian. And then solve its band structures by doing Fourier transformations, then you will find that the band structure looks like this type of band structure. You probably already like played it using Mathematica, and then you can find that there are two Dirac point sitting at the Brayton zone with the Dirac momentum, let's say plus and minus k, which equals to where k is 4 pi over 3 times root 3 and 0. So you can also draw a picture of the Brayton zone. For example, let's say its Brayton zone is actually also a hexagon, right? That's the Brayton zone. The basis vector of this Brayton zone will be, let's say, B1 equals to 2 pi over root 3 and 2 pi over 3, and B2 equals to minus 2 pi over root 3 and 2 pi over 3. That's the basis vector for the Brayton zone. And then the Dirac point actually locating at the corner of this of my Brayton zone that people usually call the k point and minus k point. So one thing you can actually show is that so if you just look at this plot, right, you can see there are six different corner point, right? But it turns out that, let's say, some of them are equivalent to each other. Let's say this point is equivalent to this and to this, right? Because they just differ by some unit vectors times integer, right? You can directly show this. Actually, it's very, yeah, you can directly show this. And so that's why we only get two Dirac points, right? So that is for the Dirac fermions. And then one thing that we want to discuss is that whether the gaplessness of Dirac fermions are protected by symmetry, right? Namely that, or in other words, we can write down all the mass term of those Dirac fermions and then ask how does those Dirac fermions transform under my microscopic symmetries, like translation symmetries, like C3 rotations, and so on, right? In the last lecture, I explained that the translation symmetries will forbid a certain mass term, right? So in particular, the translation symmetry, right? The translation symmetry will forbid a mass term looks like forbids a mass term, let's say psi dagger tau x or tau y times sigma z and psi, right? And it's very straightforward to understand that why translation symmetry forbids those mass term, because they are such mass term are basically just like the scattering between different Dirac points, this plus k and minus k, and this will carry finite momentum, right? This twice of k, and that's why it will be forbid by translation symmetry, right? But then we still have other mass term, right? Like sigma tau z times sigma z, and also sigma z itself, and those mass term are not forbid by translation symmetries, and so and in the end we need to use other symmetries to forbid that mass term. So then the next symmetry we will look at is inversion. Right, the inversion symmetry, let's draw our honeycomb lattice. Then the inversion symmetry is really that you pick up inversion center, that is the center of some bound, and then you can have inversion symmetry. And that this inversion symmetry will maps, let's say, A sublattice to B sublattice. And meanwhile, it will maps, let's say, my coordinates x, y to minus x, minus y, right? So that's how the inversion symmetry acts. So then we can ask, how does it act on my Dirac fermions? The first thing that you can figure out is that, say, if I consider fermions in the momentum space, right, I'm doing an inversion. Let's say I'm considering fermions on the A sublattice, and then I'm doing an inversion. What I will get is, say, B, and the momentum gets also reversed. So that's how the inversion symmetry acts on those fermions in the momentum space. We can very straightforwardly write down that, say, we consider Dirac fermions in the plus k point, Dirac point, which is, say, A, capital A plus small capital K plus small k, and, say, B, capital K plus small k. And then we apply an inversion symmetry, right? That will give me, say, B minus capital K minus little k, and say, A minus capital K minus little k, right? That's what we get. And this indeed equals to sigma z times, say, B minus k minus little k and minus say a minus capital K minus little k, right? And this is nothing but our Dirac fermions at the minus k Dirac point, right? So now we know how the Dirac fermions transform under the inversion symmetry. So then for this, and similarly, if we consider minus k, it will go to sigma z psi plus minus k, right? So for this one, it's very easy to work out, right? It's just the inverse. So let's say you do the inversion twice, it will should go back to itself. Then that means for this sine minus, it should also transform like this, right? So then our four component Dirac fermions, right? This capital psi, then it will act as tau x sigma z capital psi minus k, right? The reason that we have a tau x, because this inversion actually maps psi plus to psi minus, right? And looking at the Brillouin zone, you also can understand it directly, right? If you're doing inversion, right, you map this plus k to minus k, right? That's why you get you swapped those two Dirac fermions, right? So and then with this, we can immediately know that this mass term, right, capital psi sigma tau z sigma z capital psi is also forbidden, right? Right, because if I do an inversion symmetry, then I will get a minus sign here, right? Because tau x anti-commute with tau z, right? That's why this is forbidden, right? So then, so with those two symmetries, we already forbid three mass terms, and then the remaining mass is the sigma z, where in the tau space, in this valley space, we don't apply any matrix element. So for that term, that mass term, you can easily say that it commutes. It doesn't change on the inversion, and it doesn't change under the translation, right? So for that mass term, it turns out that what we need is the time reversal symmetry. Let me also write it here. So we can consider the time reversal symmetry right. So remember that the time reversal just transforms, let's say, A or B back. Let me write more clearly. Just CA goes to CA and CB goes to CB, right? It doesn't do anything on my Fermi operators except that it's an anti-unitary transformation, right? It maps I to minus I, right? That's the time reversal symmetry. So then, and then we can, in a very similar fashion, we can work out how does those fermions in momentum space transform on the time reversal symmetry, and also how those Dirac fermions will transform, right? So because in the momentum space, remember that the fermions in momentum space is something like this, right? The Fourier mode transformation of fermions in real space, right? So then, although the fermions doesn't change on the time reversal, because in Fourier transformation, I have this exponential I, so that will change the sign, right? So then that means on the time reversal, my momentum also gets changed. Let's say if I consider, capital K plus little k, then on the time reversal, I will get, say, A minus capital K minus little k, right? That is how the time reversal acts on my fermions in the momentum space. And then very similar as what I did for inversion symmetry, I can work out how does the my Dirac fermions, these two component fermions, changes under the time reversal symmetry, right? And in the end, what you will get is minus I sigma y psi minus minus k, right? Again, you swap this plus fermion and the minus fermions simply because my time reversal also reverse the momentum, right? That's why I swap those two values, and different from the inversion symmetries where the matrix element for the transformation correspond to sigma z, and here it's correspond to I minus I times sigma y. You can easily work it out. I won't repeat this here. And then for the capital psi, that our four component Dirac fermions, it will transform under as minus I times tau x times sigma y and psi, right? That's how the time reversal acts on the this four component Dirac fermions. And then you can easily figure out that this guy, psi dagger, sigma z, psi is forbidden, right? Right, simply because this tau sigma y anti-commutes with sigma z, right? That's why it's anti-commuting. That is changes psi, right? So, and similarly, you can also find that indeed this term also breaks reflection symmetry. You can play with the game by yourself. I won't do it for you. So, and then with this, we can conclude that the Dirac fermions in this graphene or on this honeycomb lattice is stable as long as you preserve, let's say, translation symmetry, inversion symmetry, and time reversal symmetry, right? And the next we can do is that we think about, or we can ask about the physical meaning of the mass term. But I can pause a little bit if there is any question.
What exactly do you mean by stable here? As in, there's no perturbation that will gap out the...
Right. There's no infinitesimal perturbation will gap out to the fermions, right? If you add very strong interactions, you can always make it unstable and give you some other phases. All right, so then let's think about the physical meanings of those mass term, right? For example, what kind of perturbations can in the end gap out the Dirac fermions? Say the physics of mass term, Dirac mass. So let's first look at this mass term. Let's say psi dagger or tau z sigma z psi. Right, we look at this term, right? Remember that this term actually breaks the inversion symmetry. It breaks inversion. But preserves translation, right? So then you can ask what type of perturbations could achieve this goal, right? One simple term you can consider is that, let's say, I'm just add staggered potential on my fermions, on my in my Hamiltonian, let's say for A sublattice it says this plus mu chemical potential, while for B sublattice it says this minus mu chemical potential. So then obviously it breaks inversion, and it preserves translation, right? Because I do it uniformly on the A sublattice and B sublattice, right? And pictorially, you can just think that, let's say, if mu is very large, then I just, let's say I have my fermions just localized at B sublattice, right? And that will, of course, correspond to a gapped state, right? And that's the physical meaning of the this mass term. And of course, you can also work out the you can add this term in your Hamiltonian and then explicitly compute its band structures. You can find that infinitesimal mu will gap out the Dirac fermions, right? It's indeed a very straightforward thing, right? Once you do Fourier transformation, you will get the Hamiltonian will look like, let's say, the matrix basically will look like mu minus mu and fk. Fk is what I introduced last lecture. It's basically something like this. And then compute its band structures, then just diagonalize it, you will find it's massive, right? As long as mu is finite, right? So we now for this mass term, we understand its meaning. And another question I would like address is that whether this C3 rotation symmetry of my Hanekom lattice is important here, right? So remember that in last lecture, I list a number of symmetries of Hanekom lattice. There's a C3 symmetries, while in this analysis, I didn't really look at what C3 symmetry is doing. Of course, you can look at it, right? Let's say play with just repeat what I did for those three symmetries, and you and then in the end, you will find that actually C3 symmetry does not really forbid any mass term. That means, indeed, you can break C3 symmetries. Even if you break C3 symmetries, you will not really gap out the Dirac fermions. The question that so I want to address is C3 symmetry, right? Is Dirac's So as I said, right, is Dirac-Kohn stable? Right. So as I said, it seems that no mass term will break C3 symmetries. So that sounds like C3 symmetry. I can break C3 symmetry without gapping out Dirac-Kohns. So indeed, we can directly play with it. Let's say I have this Hanekom lattice again. And then what I can do is that say we make the hopping to be non-invariant on the C3 rotation symmetries. In other words, let's say we just choose the bound, the vertical bound, right? I give them a different hopping. Let's say the hopping is t times lambda, and for all other bounds, the hopping is still t, right? So obviously, this choice breaks the C3 rotation, but maintains all other symmetries, right? So again, we can write down the Hamiltonian. Let me just write the corresponding matrix. It will be like minus t times zero and lambda plus exponential minus ik times a one plus exponential minus k ik times a2, right? And here will be just its conjugate. That's the new Hamiltonian under this deformation, lambda equals 1, just reduced to the original Hamiltonian we have played with. So then, again, you can just insert this Hamiltonian, this matrix in Mathematica, and then diagonalize it. And you can indeed easily find that I still have gapless Dirac fermions. So yeah. But one thing you will notice is that now this time the position of my Dirac cone gets moved. So Dirac fermion still exists. Dirac cone still exists. But its position is moved. Yeah, there's still two Dirac cones. So, but their positions are moved to some other places. So that's something you can play with. Just you can get it by just diagonalizing this. Let's say using Mathematica, right? So again, physically, indeed, you can easily understand why the positions of Dirac cones are moved, right? So again, I'm just drawing the Brillouin zone, which I already drew there. Let's say that's my Brillouin zone, right? And then once I have C3 symmetries, that means that then the Hamiltonian in the momentum space should also respect the C3 symmetries. Then its spectrum should also respect C3 symmetries, right? So then I only have two Dirac cones, right? So then in that case, if let's say I have a Dirac cone at somewhere, not at this K point, then that means I will get two another Dirac cones just by because I have this C3 symmetries, the spectrum should respect that symmetries. Right, and then for the other Dirac cones, we also will get another two. Then in total, we will have six Dirac cones. Right, and so, but obviously that's not the case for this Hamiltonian. I mean, if lambda equals one, so then the only solution is that when lambda is one, then the Dirac points are sitting at the corner of here, which so sometimes we call those points as high symmetry points, just meaning that they are invariant under certain symmetries, and those K point are really just they are invariant under C3 rotation symmetries. That's why in the end I can have the case that I am keeping C3 symmetries, and meanwhile I only have two Dirac cones. But now, if I break C3 symmetries, my spectrum no longer has that symmetries, right? Then those Dirac points can just move, right? That's why in the end, if you solve this spectrum, you'll find that the position of Dirac cones are no longer at those K points. And indeed, you can also write down the effective Dirac Hamiltonians, similar as what I have already done for lambda equals 1. And then you can find that indeed this will be the Dirac Hamiltonians will be the Hamiltonians that I write down plus a perturbation that's a proportional to something like this Px sigma x plus Py sigma y. It will get some extra term like this, and that's why it actually moves the Dirac points, right? Right. Because my Hamiltonians will be look like this, right? This is our original Dirac Hamiltonians, then you add this perturbations, you will get extra term proportional to lambda minus 1, and then those will effectively move the position of Dirac points. Right? You can work it out by yourself. All right, so that is a C3 story. The last mass term that I want to talk about is this mass term that breaks the time reversal symmetry, but preserve all other symmetries. This psi dagger sigma z psi, right? And so as I said, it breaks time reversal. But preserves all other symmetries, right? And this mass term turns out to be very important in the context of topological physics, right? So this will give you what we called a Chern insulator, which was originally proposed by Duncan Haldane. And this Chern insulator is a lattice version of integer quantum Hausse. And also that model also inspires what we know as topological insulators. So the first question we can ask is that what kind of perturbations, right, can achieve this goal, right? Let's say breaks time reversal and also, but preserves all other symmetries, right? So to break time reversal, then the natural idea is that now I'm just adding some phase factor in my hopping, right? In my hopping the real space, right? Because time reversal will make the phase factor to its conjugate, and then if the phase factor is not one, then I will break time reversal, right? So then the first guess would be, let's say we just I just consider some Hamiltonian, just modify our hopping with a phase factor. Let's say say a dagger, say b x plus EI plus Hermitian conjugate, right? So that's the first naive guess you might have. And so naively, if you look at this, right, I add a phase factor, then it will change if I do a time reversal symmetry, right? But this is actually just very misleading. Because indeed, you can easily convince yourself that this kind of modification to your Hamiltonian is really just a gauge choice, right? Because I can really just redefine my fermions, let's say on A sub lattice, back to the choose a different gauge such that I can just make this phase factor disappear, right? It's really just a gauge choice. So in the end, I recover the same Hamiltonians and which is time reversal invariant and identical to what we have studied, right? One thing we know is that the gauge invariant quantity should not be just this hopping phase, right? So we know that this hopping phase is nothing but some what we can say the vector potential of an electromagnetic field, right? And what's gauge invariant is the magnetic field or a magnetic flux, right? That's the gauge invariant quantity, and then what we want to have is that to make the such gauge invariant quantities to be non-zero, such that I can break time reversal symmetry. And then for this type of Hamiltonian, you can easily say that for any hexagon placket, right? If you consider this hopping, right? This Aij is just the phase of this hopping, right? And it's always zero, right? So then there's no flux in the system. In other words, it preserves time reversal symmetry. Right? So then the goal is then to write down some Hamiltonian that have non-zero flux in certain plaquette or in certain loops of my Hamiltonian, right? And then what Duncan Houdin came up with is that we consider a case, the situation that, let's say, again, that's my honeycomb lattice. And then he added second neighbor hoppings. That's my second neighbor. And has assigned a phase factor, let's say, along this direction, right? Assign a phase factor exponential I theta, right? And now by doing this, of course, you also need to do it for the down triangles, right? Which I'm not drawing here. So then by doing this, then you will have net flux, right? In those small triangles as well as this in these triangles you will have theta, theta, and theta. While in these triangles, you will have let's say minus 3 theta, right? The net flux in one hexagon placket is still zero, but locally, right, it's finite, and then that will break time reversal symmetry, because if you do a time reversal transformation, then you will change the sign, then locally you get a different configuration, right? So then this term breaks the time reversal symmetry, and naturally we should expect that this term will then gap out Dirac fermions, give me a mass term correspond to this psi dagger sigma z psi in the continuum limit. So you can write down the Hamiltonian of such model as, let's say, minus t. It's very simple. I guess you already know what this Hamiltonian should look like, but let me just write it down in case there are some confusions. So I have the Hamiltonians for the original model that we play with, right? Just nearest neighbor hopping. And then we can add a second neighbor hopping. Let's say the hopping amplitude is t prime. And I have a non-trivial phase factor for those hoppings. Let's say dagger A. We also need to be careful about the actual phase factor you choose here, just to make it consistent. Here I'm a bit sloppy on this. And another term is that you change A to B, right? That's the Hamiltonian, how the Hamiltonian look like. And as I said, it has you can again just solve this Hamiltonian by doing a Fourier transformation, and then you find that it's the Dirac fermions are gap out. You can even show that in the continuum limit, then the actual term you get will be this psi dagger sigma z psi. And as I said, this is called Houdin model. And he introduced this model in this paper. In 1988, and a very interesting story is that when he wrote this paper, I don't think anyone paid attention to this paper for, let's say, two two decades and so on. And here, another very famous paper that by Ken and Mei Li, that was again a PRL 5 in 2005. And until this paper came out, and that lead to a, really lead to an industry that now we know that is what we call is topological insulator. Right. I think you might have heard it several times, right? It's really a huge industry in quantum matter research in last, since that paper came out, right? And before Ken and Mei-Li's paper, I think you can, yeah, just you can check the citation of Haldane's paper, right? You can see that there's nearly no citations until this Ken Mei-Li's paper came out, and the citation just took off. Right. So the Ken Mei-Li's paper for this topological insulator, their model is actually just a double version of this Haldane model, where they consider actual spin degree freedoms, right? Right now we just have those fermions which doesn't carry spin. Sometimes we call it spinless fermions. And what Ken and Mei-Li considered a spin-full version of that, they have an actual fermionic degree freedom, and then and for spin-up fermions, the Hamiltonian takes this form, and for spin-down fermions, the Hamiltonian takes its conjugate form, namely that you just do a time reversal transformation to the spin-up Hamiltonians, then you get the spin-down Hamiltonians, and that Hamiltonian then will be time reversal invariant, where time reversal also changes the flip the this actual spin degree freedom you introduce, and then that model turns out to just describe this what we know as topological insulator in 2+1D. All right, and for this Haldane model, as I said, it's nowadays we call it a Chern insulator. The reason that we call it is because it has, model, if you look at its band structure, there will be a non-trivial topological invariant that we call a Chern number. And that's why it's called a Chern insulator. And as I said, that's a topological phase that we that's an example of topological phase people have studied for many years. And recently, there are also experiments that realize the same phase of matter for this Chern insulator, right? Yeah. So now in the last 10 minutes, I guess, 10 or 15 minutes, I will explain what is this Chern number about. I think in the tutorial, you have already heard about, let's see, the Berry phase, Chern number, and also, yeah. So for this Chern insulator story, it will be very similar. So it's one very important concept for those topological phase is that the wave function of a system can be non-trivial even if its let's say its energies looks trivial, right? In the context of those Dirac fermion stories, one thing that we can see is that let's say this Chern insulator corresponds to this mass term, this psi dagger sigma z, right? While other type of mass terms, right, correspond to different type of, I mean, if you can, you can also consider other mass term, right? If you look at their energies, right, for any Dirac mass, let's say, regardless of what gamma matrix you consider, right, for any Dirac mass, in the end, its energies will always be, let's say, plus and minus root k squared plus m squared, right? Schematically, it would be the mass term, right? And so if you look, just look at energies, right, there's no difference regarding which type of mass mass term you consider, right? And then and turns out that and then the really important concept from this topological phase is that not just the energies are important, but also the wave functions are important, right? Or in the context of band structures, people would say that the wave functions of band structure is important, right? In the past, people are mainly concerned with the gap or the energy of the band, right? We just have the idea, the concept of what is metals, what is semi-metal, and what is insulator, right? People didn't know that there are different types of insulators, right? Like normal insulator, like this chain insulator, and also topological insulator, right? And then the really conceptual breakthrough is that indeed, even if both of them are insulator with a finite energy gap, they can be fundamentally different because their wave functions are different. And in particular, topology plays a very important role. So there are various ways to understand what is this topological invariant is, in particular, what is this chain number is. So let me give you one perspective about thinking about those topological invariant. So I guess one very intuitive topological invariant we can think of is what people call a winding number, right? And this winding number formally, so the question that you can consider is that, let's say we have a circle, right, just 1D circle, and then you can parametrize the circle by the angle theta, right? And then what you do is that you on the circle you can consider a unit vector also pointing at some directions, right? You consider some unit vectors. You define unit vectors at each point of my circle, right? And then you ask, how does this unit vectors wind if I, move around this circle? And this gives winding numbers. And of course, you can also say, you can parametrize this unit vector, by a complex number, this exponential f theta, and then you just ask how this f theta changes if I move around, go one round of this circle, and what do I get, right? So, and this gives this so-called winding number, and formally, you can call it a map from S1 to S1, right? Because the first S1 is this circle. The second S1 just refers to this exponential IF theta, right? Which is a complex number, right? Which also parametrizes a circle, right? So, just ask what are the topological classifications of this F, right? So it's called homotopy group, right? And we know the classification of this. So usually we write it as pi 1 S1, and we know the classification is integer classified. And it's also very easy to write down what those maps are, right? So those maps can be just f theta. This f theta is defined as some integer m multiplies theta, right? So if m is 0, then the widening is trivial, right? If I move around the circle, nothing changes, right? And the non-trivial thing is that once m is finite, right, I'm move around this circle, right? This phase factor gets changed, right? For example, if m equals 1, right, and then I move on this circle, indeed I will find that this f theta changes from 0 to 2 pi, right? But since it's a phase factor, 0 is equivalent to 2 pi, then it just goes back to itself, right? But in this whole process, right, it's non-trivial, right? So that's then you can think that it winds the circle once, and that's why it's called widening number. You can also write down the topological invariant, which is a very trivial thing. That is m. M is just a topological invariant, and m equals to 1 over 2 pi and integral of d theta, d theta, right? It's a trivial integral, and then you can show it just equals to f. And intuitively, you can compute how this f changes gradually as I move around this circle, right? Then that's why it measures this widening. Okay, so that is one. This is for this 1D story. And then for the as far as the Chern number is concerned, what we want to consider is this 2D story. So now we go to the Chern number. And it's very similar to this story that you can consider just some map 1 space to another space, and then ask what are the topological classification of that map. And intuitively, you can really just draw pictures like this, right? Just at each point of your base space, you draw some vector or something similar, and then try to understand how those vectors change as it goes around this space. That's basically the meaning of this topological invariant. And very similar to this, you can consider that the S2, a mapping from S2 to S2, and then you get something very similar that we called a Skirmian number, which is indeed very close to the Chern number story. But let me directly go to the Chern number story and to achieve. I don't think I have much time left, so let me just give you a simple example of this Chern insulator and Chern number. So it's again, we can write it in terms of those Dirac Hamiltonians, but now I'm modifying my Dirac Hamiltonians a little bit. I'm consider a simpler case. Let's say I consider a case that say the Brillouin zone is just a square lattice. Let's say kx and ky runs from 0 to 2 pi, not this honeycomb shape of Brillouin zone of this honeycomb lattice, but the physics essentially is the same, right? So let's say we consider a Dirac Hamiltonian like this sine kx, ky, sigma y, and plus m cosine kx plus cosine ky sigma z, right? So yeah, again, there's a Dirac Hamiltonian, and you can and its mass is simple. It's just the energy gap, the energy spectrum will then just be root sine kx square sine ky square and m plus cosine kx cosine ky squared, right? So then you can verify that if m equals to 0, right? This energy spectrum has two Dirac cones, right? At let's say m equal to 0, right? We have two Dirac cones. Dirac cones at 0 pi and pi 0, right? So, and once m is finite, then I gap out the Dirac fermions, right? And the gap appears in this sigma z sector, right? Appears as a sigma z, right? Then that's really very similar to this mass term, right? I talk about for the Honeycomb lattice, right? But now I'm just considering a simple situation, right? So now what one thing we can do is that now I define a unit vector. Let's say just for notation, let's say I call this epsilon k as is, and then my energy is plus and minus epsilon k. And now I define a unit vector, let's say divide my each term in front of my sigma polymetrics with my energies, right? It's sine ky over epsilon k and m plus cosine kx plus cosine ky over epsilon k, right? That's a unit vector, right? And as long as m is not 0, then this epsilon k is always finite, right? So there's no singularity for this unit vector. Everything is fine. Okay. So now what we do is that now we consider very similar to here, where that here is a map from S1 to S1. And now what we do is that we consider a map from a torus, what we call T2, to this S2, right? This torus is nothing but that, say, kx and ky, they belongs to 0 to 2 pi, right? That's my Brillouin zone. The reason that is torus because 0 is equivalent to 2 pi, right? Then you really have, let's say, this square Brillouin zone, but then you should identify this edge to this edge, and also this edge to this edge, right? That's why it really is a torus, right? So then this Hamiltonian, actually, you can think this Hamiltonian as a map of this T2 to this S2, right? S2 is really just defined by this unit vector, right? So then you can ask what are the topological classification of this map, right? And it turns out that it's also Z-classified, and that in this example, it corresponds to the Chern number. But rigorously speaking, this topological invariant has a name called a Skirmir number. And pictorially, what you can do is really you just, that's your Brillouin zone, and then at each point of your Brillouin zone, you draw a unit vector, leave on the S2, right, and then ask how this unit vector, this vector n, changes as I move around this Brillouin zone, right, which is very similar to this Whiting number, right, and then this topological invariant is defined by 1 over 4 pi and n times partial n, partial kx cross ky and dkx, dky. That is, in literature, it's called a Skirmir number, right? And in this case, it turns out to be just mathematically equivalent to Chern number. And you can directly compute this guy, right? And let's say using Mathematica again, and then you can find that the C equals to, let's say, minus 1 if m is larger than 0 and smaller than 2, and it's 1 if m is larger than minus 2, smaller than 0, and it's 0 if m's absolute value is larger than 2, right? So that's really an integer, and it's a topological number in the sense that its value is always quantized regardless of the concrete the specific value of this m, right? As long as it lives in certain region, right? Of course, it can change if it crosses some phase transitions, right? For this plus 1 to minus 1, because we know that when m equals to 0, right, there's dual cones, and then this energy gap has 0 point, and then this for this unit vector, it will be singular at those dual point. That's why that's how you can get transitions, right? Similarly, for m equals 2 or minus 2, you can indeed also find that there are Dirac points in this Hamiltonian, and that's why it can also change its values, right? So so that is this Skirmir number or Chern number, right? And schematically, again, you can as I said, pictorially, that's really, you can think it as Majorette Skirmir's number, right? You can literally just draw your Brillouin zone and then just plot this unit vector, right? And what you can find is that, let's say, m is larger than 2, then the direction of this unit vector will always look like, let's say, pointing to the z directions, right? Regardless where you are looking at this unit vector, right? That it's always dominant by this component, right? And schematically, I'm drawing it like this. That's why its Skirmir number is 0. It's just 0, right? If it's, the change is very mild, right? And for the case, let's say m larger than 0, smaller than 2, if you do the similar thing, then you will find that actually it will have some non-trivial pattern, right? On the edge, it may still dominant. Let's say the vector will still mainly pointing towards the board. But then if you go to the middle of the my Brillouin zone, it will actually point towards another direction, right? So it may looks like this. So then if you move around this Brillouin, the whole space, then you will find that this vector actually change it, then you will find a non-trivial configuration, right? That is what people call the Skirmir. So this this picture is very similar to this winding number, where you just think about how this unit vector winds in my space, right? You can, and for a nicer picture about how this Skirmir looks like, you can just Google it, and then you can find very nice pictures about this Skirmirs. And there's also some interesting topological object that people have studied and observed in certain materials of magnets. So I think I should stop here. So any questions? Actually, when did I start? When did this course start? It's
3:45.
Okay, then it's more than 1 hour. Okay, good.
So this equivalence between the Skirmir number and the Chern number.
Yeah.
When does that hold? How general is that?
That's a good question. How general is that? I don't know the precise answer for that, actually. I can throw some mathematical words to you, but I'm not sure if you really understand. You can really understand, but let me say it anyway. So those Sgermian numbers, as I said, it corresponds to these topological class of this mapping, right? And it's called a homotopy group, right? And strictly speaking, a trend number is not a homotopy, doesn't correspond to homotopy group, but it corresponds to the what people call cohomology group. And then it just in this case, it turns out that they are equivalent, right? For this case, and so in literature, let's say, so for homotopy group, it's written as this pi n, and just correspond to, you consider S1 or S2 and so on, right? And then Chern number is roughly, in this case, will be pi 2, right? And the cohomology is, usually people write something like this, yeah. And then just there's some mathematical theorem saying that, let's say, if you consider a space, let's say, if pi 1, so for this case, if pi 1 of some space, let's say M, is trivial, then pi 2 is equivalent to H2 M. That's why it's, in the end, they're the same. Right? So I don't know. Yeah, so I don't know whether I should call it some general feature or just a special case here. But in the end, they're really like this. And normally, to define Chern number, what you need to do is that you need to use wave functions of this band and then define Barry curvatures and then integrate over the Barry curvatures and get Chern number. Right? That's the cohomology definition. Right? And this is it just turns out that for this case, they're equivalent.